Hello and welcome to episode 46 of Exploring Environmental History. I'm Jan Oostoek. Many studies in historical climatology develop narratives of inevitable decline in the face of climatic fluctuation. A recent study by a team led by David Zhang of the University of Hong Kong claims that wars, inflation, famines, and shrinking humans in 17th century Europe can be linked to the effects of the Little Ice Age. However, this claim seems very general and somewhat one-dimensional because the opposite also occurred. The Little Ice Age coincided with the maritime expansion of Europe and the creation of seaborne trading and later colonial empires. First came the Spanish and Portuguese, followed by the Dutch, English and other European nations. Key to this success was the development of shipbuilding technology, which was a response to both trading, strategic and perhaps also climatic pressures. Art and architecture also flourished, which is probably best embodied in the wonderful winter landscape paintings of the Dutch masters, which can be considered a direct result of the Little Ice Age. These paintings show us skating people enjoying themselves, a sign that they were more than capable to withstand the harsher winter conditions, and that they had also enough food. Not exactly the image of decline caused by climatic fluctuation. It seems that culture was resilient enough to withstand climatic fluctuations and even did not suffer from this. My guest on this episode of the podcast is Dagomar de Groot, a PhD candidate in environmental history at York University in Toronto, Canada. His research explores the issue of how the changing climate in the Little Ice Age influenced the cultural, military and economic histories of the Dutch Republic during the early modern period. We will talk about some of the pitfalls of this type of research, the resources available to historians researching climate, and the relevance to present-day debates about global warming and climate change. Dagomar, welcome on the podcast.
Thank you so much.
So let's start with a very basic question. You're working in the area of historical climatology. So what is historical climatology?
Well, historical climatology is an interdisciplinary field concerned first with the reconstruction of past climates, second with the relationship between changes in those climates and trends or events in human history, and third with the way in which past societies understood the changing climate of their times. In the humanities, it is a subfield of environmental history. In science, it is typically part of climatology, and it can also be practiced by archaeologists. Attempts to relate the distribution and later the fluctuation of regional or global climates to human histories go back thousands of years, but historical climatology as practiced today really has its roots in the work of people like Hubert Lam and Christian Pfister in the 1970s and 1980s. Like environmental history, its development was, in some respects, a response to a growing awareness that the environment is not stable and that humans are damaging it. Historical climatologists look at everything from ice cores to scraps of personal correspondence to trace past climates. To relate those climates to human histories, we literally look at any kind of document that directly or indirectly mentions weather.
So your research looks to a period which is known as the Little Ice Age and how it influenced, as I mentioned before, the history of the Dutch Republic. Can you tell us a little bit more of what your project aims to achieve?
The Little Ice Age was a period of global climatic variability between the end of the 13th century and the middle of the 19th century. In much of Europe, three roughly 70-year periods of remarkably cold temperatures, increased storminess, and heightened precipitation were separated by decades of warmer, drier, more tranquil weather. For many historical climatologists looking at, say, the availability of cereals in pre-industrial Europe, cold, wet, stormy weather worsened life for most people, while harming the European economy. On the other hand, periods of warmth, like those experienced in the high medieval centuries, are frequently seen as largely beneficial, although too much warmth is also a bad thing. Now, that all makes sense if you ignore the Dutch economic miracle, which transformed the little sliver of land on the periphery of Europe into the first real center of global capitalism, just as the Little Ice Age entered its coldest phase. So, on contributing to the reconstruction of the climate of the Little Ice Age, while exploring how the foundations of Dutch prosperity at sea and on land adapted in warmer and cooler decades. In the process, I'm creating a history of climatic fluctuation in a society that was, in some respects, not that different from our own, while developing what, to my knowledge, is the first study of humans and pre-industrial climate change at sea.
So what sources are you using for your research? What is available?
Yeah, well, my primary sources include ship logbooks, weather diaries, personal correspondence, court records, government or corporate accounts, and much more. I look at everything from tax accounts recording money assigned to breaking ice in town harbors to intelligence reports written by foreign spies in times of war. Beyond history books and articles, my secondary sources also include many scientific studies. Like most environmental historians, historical climatologists require some scientific literacy, so I need to know something about, for example, the circumpolar vortex, the North Atlantic Oscillation, or why using tree rings can be a little bit tricky sometimes.
A lot of your data is qualitative in nature. How do you translate the language used in these sources into data that can be reliably used for meaningful climate reconstruction? I know that some other people have tried this as well, for example, Dennis Wheeler at the University of Sunderland. How do you translate qualitative data into numerical data?
Well, it depends on the kind of climatic data you want to get and the kind of sources that you're working with. We know a lot about European temperatures during the Little Ice Age because historical climatologists have developed methodologies for translating regional weather descriptions into quantitative data that, when placed on a scale of, say, -3 to +3, reliably reconstructs past climatic fluctuations. As an example, a document may record that the ice on a river was as thick as 3 fingers. Well, we can figure out how cold it had to have been for the river to freeze to that extent, as long as we take into account social and environmental changes that might alter, for example, the speed of the current. Such data, while valuable in its own right, is greatly strengthened by, for example, tree ring records or measurements of glacial expansion and retreat compiled by scientists. All of that evidence can be plugged into models, which give us a pretty good idea of what's going on. Now, a lot of good temperature data exists for the Netherlands, and we have a pretty good record of shifts in precipitation and the date of major storms. What I'm contributing to that picture is an account of long-term changes in wind direction and intensity. We know very little about past wind patterns, in part because it's not sufficient to look at sources compiled on land, where wind directions can be altered by various natural and artificial structures. So I am actually following in the footsteps of Dennis Wheeler by creating databases of meteorological measurements found in previously unexamined ship logbooks. And these were often extremely accurate because early modern mariners, lacking the capability to precisely calculate longitude, had to keep track of all the influences on their ship's course. The most important of these were simulated by changes in weather and ocean currents. I look at enough ship logbooks to create a sample size that allows me to quantify measurements like wind from the east into graphs reflecting long-term shifts in wind direction. Meanwhile, historical climatologists have converted descriptions of wind intensity into modern nautical language, which in turn precisely translates into speed by kilometer an hour. That makes my work a lot more doable, if not necessarily any less time intensive.
So has your research already thrown up some interesting results?
Yeah, definitely. My analysis of ship logbooks accounts, diaries, and personal correspondence has allowed me to suggest that easterly winds grew more common during the coldest phases of the Little Ice Age. The frequency of high winds also appears to have increased, and these were often expressed in unusually abundant gales. More frequent easterly winds in the North Sea region appear to have accelerated the journeys of outbound Dutch East India Company ships. Meanwhile, I've shown that easterlies frequently allowed Dutch fleets to set the terms of battle in the North Sea, giving them a crucial advantage, say, over English fleets sailing from the west during the Anglo-Dutch Wars. I've used accounts to trace how severe winters and stormy weather influenced Dutch maritime trade with the Baltic and affected traffic through the network of canals that supported the economy at home. In both cases, traffic suffered during cold winters, but these same conditions actually appear to have influenced the migratory patterns of fish and whales in ways that made them easier for the Dutch to capture. Ultimately, my research supports three big ideas. First, climate change is about more than fluctuations in temperature. Every imaginable form of weather can be altered, often with unanticipated consequences. Second, the influence of a climatic shift is never straightforward, and there will be winners and losers, or at least losers and big losers. Third, and this is related, different societies have different patterns of vulnerability and resilience. There does appear to have been something about the unique cultural, political, and economic structure of the Dutch Republic that allowed it to respond more constructively to the climatic fluctuations of the Little Ice Age than its European neighbors.
One of the problems that a lot of people always point out when they talk about historical climatology or historical studies into climate and weather is that there's a trap of climatical determinism. So if you see, you know, the weather is really cold, then it explains a certain victory, for example, of an army. The problem is, of course, that do these correlations really exist? And how do you guard yourself from falling into the trap of determinism or even indeterminism?
Yeah, I mean, that danger is very real. Although I do think it can be overstated because it's not unique either to historical climatology or environmental history. Cultural historians, for example, have to guard against cultural determinism. And, you know, we all know that political historians have to guard against the temptation to assign all historical change to the decisions of a few wealthy elites. With that said, historical climatologists within the historical discipline still have to be wary of the legacy of climatic determinism, as you pointed out. And here I mean less the old sort of Northern European idea that their harsh climate somehow made them superior, and more a series of climatically deterministic narratives written in the early 20th century that did much to discredit any attempt to link human and climatic histories. It was only about 40 years ago that historians and scientists started to compile sufficiently accurate data that allowed for more than vague correlations between climate, weather, and historical events. And since then, even the part of the discipline grounded in the humanities has taken on the scientific obsession with precision. In many respects, that older, anal-school type history, where everything must be quantified, lives on in some expressions of environmental history, and especially historical climatology. I think that can be dangerous when we discard an abundance of good evidence in favor of a small amount of virtually unimpeachable evidence. I think we need to remember that there is a point where more precision and more documentation don't necessarily equate to greater accuracy. Now, outside of the historical discipline, an ongoing frustration for me is the easy links between human and climatic histories occasionally made by popularizers and scientists alike. One best-selling book about the Little Ice Age starts with two graphs. First depicts the highs and lows of early modern European history, and the second records long-term fluctuations in temperature. Not surprisingly for the author, times of crisis always accompany cooler weather. Another recent scientific study juxtaposes El Nino events with spikes in warfare over the past few centuries, concluding that the two are linked. That kind of work reveals the classic weakness of quantitative history, where we look for similarities in two graphs and we see what we want to see. Sometimes all we have to work with is quantitative data, especially as our inquiries go farther back in time. But to do much more than speculate about connections, it helps to have qualitative evidence that shows you how people at the time understood what was going on. I can have a graph showing an increase in easterly winds, another showing that ship journey shortened, but I can only really make solid conclusions when I find a source that says, the wind blew from the east, so we moved faster. Ultimately, environmental historians always need to consider the environment as just one influence shaping historical events. And that can be hard to remember when you view environmental history as the ultimate history from below, but it's important if we want to continue building the legitimacy of our discipline, just as it's really entering the mainstream of our profession.
Yeah, it's always a tricky thing to do, also when you're teaching and in the classroom talking about things like a Little Ice Age. Well, when I was teaching in Northern Britain, of course, Scotland always comes up because a lot of people in the literature talk about how harsh the conditions were in the Highlands during the Little Ice Age. But I always point out to students that during the height of the Little Ice Age, the coldest period, the population in the Scottish Highlands was actually at a peak, not exactly in decline. So the question is, you know, why can a population feed itself properly well, the climatic conditions are, you know, harsher than before, perceived to be harsher than before. And that is something that no one has really looked into, for example, and explained that, because that cannot be, there is no climatic link there. It's a cultural and probably economic and social factors that are determining these things in this case.
I mean, it might well be, but the other interesting thing is that sometimes climate and weather influence populations in the opposite way than we would expect. And a good example, if I can remember this correctly, is, okay, so if there's a cold winter in the Netherlands, it's oftentimes going to damage crops, damage seeds that you plant. But at the same time, if there's a lot of snow, there will be fewer mice. And if there's fewer mice, they will eat fewer seeds, and you actually might have a better crop at the end of the day. So, you know, it's interesting how those relationships work. And the worst thing that we can do is assume that there's a straightforward connection, because there often isn't.
It shows us again that environmental history, because we talk about the past here, is not just about a past, but also about the present, because we try to, you know, figure out what global warming is going to do. So in what way can your research contribute to the debate surrounding global warming and climate change?
First and foremost, global warming only makes sense in the context of the past. The world has to be warming relative to something, and that's where historical climatology comes in. By reconstructing past climates, we contribute to an understanding of what makes today's climate unique. My work demonstrates that wind patterns change alongside other meteorological variables as a climate warms or cools. That insight has consequences for the way in which we predict anything from future shifts in patterns of disease, transmission to changes in arc and agricultural productivity. Second, right now, many of the same scientists who model the course of global warming also project how it will influence future societies. And that can be useful, but ultimately it's scholars in other disciplines, especially environmental history, who specialize in uncovering relationships between humanity and environment. The kind of work I'm doing can provide insight into how past societies coped with a shifting climate, the kind of insight that can be useful as we struggle to make sense of the future. Obviously, I can't make predictions about how modern societies will handle warming by explaining how an early modern economy dealt with cooling. On the other hand, I believe anyway that I can develop methodologies, models, and ultimately narratives that, if not always directly applicable, at least lead to a greater understanding of the complexity of relationships between climate and society. So perhaps the next time you hear someone say that a shifting climate will cause something, much as, you know, like you just talked about, you'll think of historical climatology.
So in this context, it's also important not just to talk to scientists, but also to reach a wider public, to make them aware of the complexities of climate and how it affects historical trends. You're maintaining a blog on historical climatology at historicalclimatology.com. This blog is clearly aimed at a wider public than just academics. What do you think is the role of such blogs in making history more relevant or active online? And what does it mean for the historical, for history or indeed academic disciplines in how it changes the relationship between academics and the wider public?
So what I'll do, I guess, is very briefly talk about how I found the website. I actually initially started as a personal website, and I thought that naming the website after the discipline might attract like-minded academics interested in the kind of work I do, so I gain more exposure, I guess. A couple months later, I created the Climate History Network with environmental historian Sam White, and that was intended to be a professional network connecting historical climatologists from around the world, because a discipline can get, I mean, there can be a real gap between the European side of it and the North American side of it. And shortly after, I guess maybe about a month after we did that, I realized by checking the stats that historicalclimatology.com was on pace to receive 10,000 hits a year. And that surprised me, in part because of the name. And at that point, I decided to build the site as a resource, not only for academics, but for anyone interested in what historical climatology and environmental history can contribute to our understanding of global warming. So now I provide links and videos, interpretation of major news stories, tools allowing people to create their own climatic reconstructions, obviously my blog, and a lot more. This year, the site is on pace for 30,000 hits a year, and recently it was featured as a link in a BBC news article. But the best part for me, and I think this answers part of your question, is seeing how people on forums correct, for example, global warming deniers by linking to my website. And a good example of that actually is a recent study that came out, and the headline on many news stories was, new study, pre-ring study, proves that the world is cooling. But what it actually indicates is that Finland may have been cooling until around 1960 by, a small amount every 1,000 years, possibly. So those are the types of things that we can then unpack, I think, in our websites. And obviously, we have a popular website as well. So the role that I see for these types of websites is twofold. For one, we can disseminate information through our disciplines. But perhaps the most interesting part for me is active history. I think digital online history can provide new links between the public and the ivory tower in a way that makes historians more important sort of spokespeople, much more important influences in their society.
I'm glad to see things like your blog developing, and they spring up everywhere, and that's a very positive development. When I started my own website in the late 1990s, I was the only one, more or less. But I think it now really starts to break through to the wider historical community that this is the way forward in order to make our work relevant. We can't just go on sitting behind our own desks and talking to one another. So this is great that this is happening.
It's fascinating, actually, because I was involved, and I am involved, I guess, in another network, and it's just being set up now. And there's this drive to create a website because there's this understanding that we have to have a website. And that's really so different than the way it must have been, 5 or 10 years ago. A website is now a critical expression of a serious network, a serious academic network. Yeah, I think you're absolutely right.
I look forward to this new initiative when it becomes available online, and also good luck with your research, which is extremely interesting, and which I'm sure a lot of other people will follow in the coming years. Well, thank you for joining me on the podcast.
Thanks so much, and I'm excited to be part of it.
Dagamar's website and blog can be visited at www.historicalclimatology.com. Dagamar, with help of Sam White of Oberlin College, has also developed the Climate History Network. The network site features news relevant to the field of historical climatology, a members' blog, a database of researchers, and extensive bibliographical teaching, funding, and job hunting resources. Access the network at climatehistorynetwork.com. And that brings us to the end of this episode of the podcast. If you have any questions or comments, do not hesitate to contact me by email at kjwostuk@eh-resources.org. Thank you for listening, and I hope that you will be joining me again next time for an episode of Exploring Environmental History. This is Jan Oostuk from Brisbane, Australia.